The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 297 Premium for Wednesday, November 10th, 2010.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to this premium edition of the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. We don't need to tell you what the show's about because you already know, and thank you very kindly for being a subscriber. We appreciate each and every one of you. From Durham, New Hampshire, I am Dave Hamilton.
And John Efron here in Fearful, Connecticut. And also...
Hey, Pilot Pete's back. Two episodes in a row.
Yeah,
is launch that the legal? Balloons. Yeah, I'm not sure it is.
Is that what the protests are about?
Yeah, something like that. That's right. Exactly. So, although technically I am sick because I did lop off a piece of my ear. So
That's right.
So if the chief pilot's listening, I really do have a medical condition.
He does. That's right. He can.
Oh, wait, I can re-record the. Let's go back and do another date. What we'll say. It's,
yeah. There we go.
At first, I thought you were serious. I'm like, wait, did he screw up the date? Because that happens, folks. You know, we start things here, and for example, the last show, we rarely ever get the second take right. Most of the time, it's the first take, but I believe second takes are the hardest to get right. Usually, because Pete screws it up. I think it's intentional.
I try not to talk too much in the intro.
Yeah, but if we have to restart, it's almost always the third time is the charm. But this is the first take of this one. So if you're hearing this, it means everything went really, really well. And that said, John, I'm going to go ahead and make sure I'm recording the right thing. And I am. So let's go to Adam.
Hey, John and Dave. This is Adam in Bend, Oregon. I got a little tip. For mail, and then the question following up after that regarding mail, Mac mail. The tip that I have essentially relates to having certain issues with your mail account, as in, like, I have Sync Together, which I saw on you guys or listened to on your podcast at one point in time. Somehow it muddled up my mail between my laptop and my desktop. Essentially what happened is it went in and it tweaked on the plist file a port number, and it basically made it so I wasn't unable to receive or send email on my Mac account. So essentially what I had to do is the tip being go into my plist editor after going through a few steps, troubleshooting, trying to figure out where it was at. And then actually through Time Machine, actually found a difference between the two, what was current and what was before I did the sync together. Found it and then went in the plist editor and essentially took that port that it was enabling and the delivery accounts on the com.apple.mail.plist. And I essentially had to delete that. And then everything worked fine. So some things seem like they're, you know, really difficult, and sometimes it seems like it's the only option is a nuke and pave. Sometimes the whole computer, sometimes certain portions of it, like replacing the plist, which inevitably would have other ramifications of, you know, things that you've been doing currently. You might lose some stuff. Things have changed, you know, since the error. So it's kind of simple. But yeah, it does take a little bit of time to go through it. And a PLS editor is not exactly something you should be terribly afraid of. Okay.
All right. So, he does have a question that he's going to ask, but I wanted to talk about this because, and the question's related. So we won't go too deep, but I like the troubleshooting procedure that he went through here, where he used Time Machine to pull up an older copy of a file to AB to see what had changed. I think that's a very cool idea, especially with regards to preference files. If something used to work and now it doesn't, you know, look at the files by date and figure out what's changed, and then AB them with your backup to see what that change was. I think that's really, really cool. John,
I like it.
Yeah.
In this instance, if I understand, and I think the second question will go on to that, but I don't know if he needed to go to that level, but I applaud him for doing so. And I think in general, and also it's, you know, we've suggested sometimes in the past when you do nuke AP list file, either use Time Machine, which everybody should be, or make a backup before you whack a file.
Right.
Because it may not get reused. In almost all cases, that's one of the first things the program does is say, hey, is my plist file here? Oh, it's not. All right. Well, I better fill one out with some defaults quick.
Right. Good point. All right. So let's go on to his question because it's related.
That's the first part. Second part is the question, syncing together my desktop and my laptop on the mail. Certain things, yes, you can drag your files over and basically replace the mail on the laptop and make it just like your desktop. Okay, that's fine. Now you go on the road. A lot of outfits, ISPs, either a business or whatever, will block whatever port you're using, thinking that somebody's trying to spam through their system with your email. Is there anything new out there that essentially lets you mask your mail ports so they don't know that you're actually sending mail through their system, whether it be ISP or business, through their firewalls, so that you can actually run your laptop just like it, you know, as if it were at home?
Yep, there is, and I think we've got enough of the question here. So what Adam is talking about is oftentimes, especially on hotel networks or shared Wi-Fi networks, when you try to send mail, it will block outgoing connections on port 25. And the reason it does this is because port 25 is, of course, what's used for talking to for mail servers to talk to each other. Computers, individual clients are actually not supposed to talk on that port, although many do because that's the port that mail servers are always going to answer on. But really, that's built for server-to-server communication. And what happens is a lot of spam, and typically Windows viruses generate this stuff, blast out spam to these ports. And of course, that's bad. And you don't want your public access Wi-Fi network to be this magnet for people that want to spam or even people that unknowingly are spamming because they've got some virus on their machine. So they just simply block port 25 and you're done. There are, of course, other ports to use. And you can see these listed inside Mail's preferences. John, I think you had the path when we prepped this the other day. Do you have it in front of you now?
For the outgoing?
Yeah, for outgoing. How to get there in Mail, right?
So you got a file.
No.
Preference. I'm sorry.
You got a
what
mail.
Do you mean no?
You know, the preferences is not in the file menu.
Oh, wait. Mail menu. You're yes. Correct. Okay, because I had the other window up. And then accounts, and you click on the account in question, and you'll see an account information tab at the bottom is a choice outgoing mail server.
Yep.
Oh, that's not quite it. But then if you go to the edit SMTP server list entry, which you told me about this, Dave, and they hide that pretty well.
Yep.
And then that's a list of all the SMTP servers that are known to mail. And I think this kind of addresses the earlier question, too. I'm wondering if the plist entry was, in fact, something that this setting could also have addressed.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's right. So in there, you've got two tabs. You have account information and advanced. Go to the advanced tab and you'll see mail says use default ports. And then it lists 25, 467 and 587 or use a custom port. I recommend for everyone, especially people with mobile devices, your iPods, your iPhones, your iPads, and of course your MacBooks or MacBook Pros. I highly recommend using a custom port here. So port 25 is what we discussed, the kind of the server to server port for mail. Port 587 is the unencrypted. And it can be encrypted, so it's not entirely correct. But port 587 is the non-SSL port to be used by an individual client to talk to a mail server to submit a new message. So at the very least, you want to use 587, and most mail servers are going to answer on that. However, the best port to use is 465, and then you want to check that use secure sockets layer checkbox right below that. That's the port you want to send mail on. And my guess is it's certainly public networks are going to block port 25 most often. Some might even block 587, but I can't imagine any that would block port 465, because 465 is the SSL port. Typically, it requires authentication, so you've got to use, you know, your username and password that you would use for the mail server, and that should work just fine. If it doesn't, if your mail server doesn't support SSL outbound, and I think all of them, well, most of them do these days, go get a Gmail account, and then that will that'll certainly let you do it. But that's the magic answer there. And I think, like you said, John, I think this is where the setting that Adam found in the plist file actually lives in the user interface here.
Right. The only other thing I'll mention when you're traveling, what'll happen is that normally your mail, at least if you're doing SNMP, you know, outbound, normally expects someone on its own network to talk to it. And a lot of times if you're on the road and you plugged into a hotel network, of course, you're on a different network.
Right.
And if your SNMP server is the same, then normally if it lets you get to it, which it has in the past, and I'll finish this up. Normally it'll say, what are you, nuts? I'm not going to talk to you because
sure,
you're trying to get to the mail server. And I think this is called an open relay, which they want to avoid. Or that's another problem. But if a outgoing mail server sees you're coming from outside, it's going to reject it because that, you know, can cause lots of spam. What I've had,
if you're doing ports 465, that's what it's built for. Right.
Right. So right. Yeah. 25 being a legacy thing and all that. Usually those are clamped down, and typically they're not authenticated either. And that if you can talk to it, a lot of them, yeah, they don't even ask for a password or anything. But what you can do is,
you know, to just be clear, and then I'll let you finish. Port 25 is meant for mail coming into a mail server. So, for example, the server that handles backbeatmedia.com's mail, it's not going to accept mail from the entire world, as long as that mail is for Backbeat Media or MacObserver.com or, you know, whatever. As long as that mail is for a domain that it hosts, it will accept it. But if, for example, you try to send mail to someone at Mac.com on that server, it's going to say, oh, no, that person's not, that domain isn't here. I'm not going to accept that mail. You've got to go send that through a server that you've got to talk to Mac.com's mail server. And that's where that's why port 25 has to be open to the world, because the server's got to accept its own mail, but it's going to block everything else. And that's why 25, like I said, is really for server to server communication. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there you go.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Though, yeah. Of course, it's I agree. But, you know, you can be specified in the mail client. And sometimes if you can find the name of the outgoing mail server on the network that you're on, then it'll accept it. In which case you'd have to get the IP and then reverse lookup and all that stuff. And I've done that. So, you know, say you're at, you know, in a hotel, and maybe it's mail.hotel.com that is the outgoing mail server on that network, in which case then you would be able to send the mail. But, the other things I agree are, you know, much better way to solve the problem. Or webmail. You know, I find that's the most portable thing.
Yeah, good point. Good point. That's right. Webmail deals with it because the mail's being sent through the server you're talking to, not through not from your client.
I'll often do that when I'm traveling. I won't even bother trying to wrestle with mail app. I'll just, you know, go to Safari.
Yeah. Good call. All right. Moving on to Chris. Chris says a Firefox extension was recently released that allows its user to view the active web sessions of the other people on a public network and allow them to log into that user's account. A person using this extension can easily gain full control over another user's account on sites such as Facebook, Twitter, and Google. And, you know, he didn't put the name of this in here, and we ran an article on it at TMO, and I can't remember the name of the extension. Do you remember the name of either one of you? Remember the name of this extension? I'll let you guys look it up, and I'll explain. I'll explain what it does. Essentially, it sits and monitors the traffic on the local network and picks up the way the authentication is working between, let's say, Pete and I are on the same network, because we are. If Pete goes and interacts with Facebook from here, and I'm running this extension inside Firefox on my computer, as long as we're on the same local network, which we are, my computer can see that traffic and then act as though I'm Pete's computer and go interact with Facebook. I could cancel his account. I could, you know, certainly post to his wall. And the same is true with Twitter. And I think also, as Chris points out, Google services. Anybody got the
I'm looking.
You're still looking. OK, so we'll come back with the name of the extension. But as Chris, moving on with Chris's question, he says, needless to say, this is concerning to anyone who uses an unencrypted public Wi-Fi network. In fact, it could be an encrypted network. As long as all users are on it, it doesn't matter if the network itself has encryption. So Chris goes on to ask, I have another Mac running at home and was wondering if it would be possible to VPN from my mobile device to my home Mac. This should give me a secure tunnel from my device on a public Wi-Fi hotspot and allow all of my internet traffic to go through my service at home. Mac laptops, iPhones, and iPod touches all support VPN connections. Do you guys know of a way to do this? So essentially what Chris is asking to do is, instead of having, if he's on a public network, it might be a he, it might be a she, I don't know. If you know, from a public network, normally your device, iPhone, iPad, computer, is going to talk directly to, in this instance, Facebook, right? What Chris wants to do is tunnel to his computer at home so that his device talks to his computer at home, and then his computer at home acts essentially as a proxy on his behalf, although we're not really talking about a proxy server in that sense, but it acts on his behalf to reroute that request to and from Facebook. That way, only the people on Chris's local network at home could compromise his data. And in all, you know, it, for the most part, that's going to be okay.
Fire sheep.
Yeah. That's it. That's right.
Well, and the question I had, let's say you don't do the VPN. As long as you're on a secure link to, say, your bank, then you're still in a tunnel anyway, as it were. No one can see. That's still encrypted traffic.
To your bank. But right. But Twitter and
Facebook, all the open stuff is open.
Sure. That's right.
Sure.
Yes. Secure web pages are still secure with FireSheep. That's right. Okay. So the question is, and this question, we could go on forever with the answer to this, John, but the question is, what can Chris do at home in order to set up a VPN, which is a virtual private network, or a tunnel between his computer or devices remotely and his connection at home? What can Chris do at home to act as a server for this VPN? As Chris said, all these devices have the ability to be a VPN client, but they don't, apparently, on the surface anyway, have the ability to be a VPN server. So how does Chris go about setting up a VPN server at home without driving himself bonkers?
Well, you know, I think there are a couple of ways there. I think you have the first and I would say preferred way. So,
all right. So I'll go
VPN services. Just
go ahead. Yeah.
And then, so VPN, virtual private network. So I think it accomplishes two things. One, it makes you a virtual, though distant, member of a network, like a home network. And then it gives you an address that makes you part of that network or appear to be part of that network. And the traffic is secured or encrypted.
Okay.
So I think those are the two things that are accomplished. Now, where you accomplish it is the big question here. And VPN, it can be implemented in multiple places. And I think the best solution is something that you do, Dave.
I do.
So one option here is to have the VPN software on
your router. That's right. So, you know, you've got your cable modem or DSL modem or whatever it is that provides your internet access to your house or your office or whatever it is. And then typically most people have a router connected directly to that. You might have an Apple Airport base station. You might have a time capsule. You might have a Linksys router, you know, D-Link, Netgear, any of those, right? Something that's going to manage your network, share your network connection amongst all your computers and all that good stuff. It is possible for that router, for that device, to be a VPN server. Now, Apple's devices do not have the software in them to support this. Most devices don't. You've heard me talk about, if you've listened to the show for any length of time, you've heard me talk about a firmware called DD-WRT. It's a third-party firmware. It's free to get, and you can install it on a lot of third-party routers. Apple routers not included in that list. However, it's much easier if you're going to start out of the gate to simply buy a router that has it. And there is one company that sells routers with DDWRT built in, and that is Buffalo. They're WZRHP G300NH is a router that has the full DDWRT, including VPN services built in, and it makes it really easy to set this up. You don't have to leave a computer on. Your router's going to be on all the time anyway. And you don't have to worry about, you know, your router's firewall getting in the way of anything else. It just does it. And it works really, really well. I use it all the time when I travel, not only for what Chris is talking about, but also to connect to my computers at home. If I want to remote control a computer or whatever, I connect to the VPN, and then it's as though I'm here at home. I don't get to see my family, of course, but I don't get to sleep in my own bed, but I do get to control my computers and print to my printer as if I was here. So that's one option. But if you've already got a router and you don't want to buy any more hardware and you want to use a computer that you already have at home, like Chris does, John.
And here's the other option. And then once we're done, we'll talk about how to actually connect to it.
Right.
But that comes at the end. So the other option, Dave, is you would take a computer that's on your network and make it a VPN server.
Okay.
And Apple, as it so happens, makes a OS product that does this called Mac OS X Server. And so what that has is equivalent to what you're talking about. The VPN software, rather than being in the router, is in the Mac OS X Server computer. And I won't go into the gory details of setting it up. Now, the interesting thing, though, Dave, is that you can accomplish this. So the easy way to do it is to buy Mac OS X Server, and it has all the administration tools. Because there's a lot involved in doing
this. The Buffalo
this.
Router is going to be significantly cheaper than Mac OS
X Server. Sure,
sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I forget how much that is off the top of my head.
Yeah. And not cheap.
Okay. The nice thing, though, is that the guts of this, like a lot of things in OS X, the guts of how to do this are buried in the operating system. It's just that OS X Server offers you a nice way to administer and manage it, because there's key creation and routing tables and, you know, IP ranges and all that stuff. But there are ways to accomplish it on client. And one that I found, Dave, I haven't tried it yet, but it's something I think was open source, and now it's a product you can buy. It's called IVPN. And it provides access to some of the things underneath the covers. Like, for example, if you want to see, you know, just get a glimpse of what this is all about, if you go to the terminal and you do man VPND, most things, of course, in Unix, when they end with D is a daemon or demon, and that's usually, you know, a server type process, I think, typically. Anyways, there's something called VPND, and it is on the client version of Mac OS X. So the thing is, there is the potential. Yeah, well, go to the command line and type VPND.
I already did. I'm following my
There's another
my
process.
You said to do this,
yeah.
So I did it.
there's IVPND. I want to try it, but it claims to let you have set up a VPN server without having the Mac OS X Server product. There are also articles. I found one at Mac OS X Hints and another at theilluminatedengineer.com. There was a pretty good, from what I could see, step-by-step of all the nastiness you have to go through in order to set up a Mac OS X non-server system in order to offer VPN services. So, two options. I'm with you. I would much rather get a device that has it built into the firmware.
Oh, yeah.
And then the other side, now how do you get to this? And the thing is, it is kind of hidden here, but if you want to see how you would go about this, Dave, they used to have something called, I think it was Internet Connect, but they got rid of that app. And now it's actually part of the network control system preference.
That's right.
I'm gonna stop saying that. So
yep.
It's burned in my brain. So if you go to System Preferences, Network, and in the lower left-hand corner of that screen, so you should see a list of your interfaces, like Ethernet, Bluetooth, modem, think well, at least on this computer.
Right.
If you click on the plus sign, it will then say, oh, could you define a new interface for me? And you're like, sure. And there's going to be a choice, VPN. If you're on Leopard, you're going to get L2TP over IPsec and PPTP, which are two different VPN protocols.
Okay.
Under Snow Leopard, fortunately, they added this Cisco IPsec.
Yep.
which works with Cisco. I guess they call them concentrators, but this is something that I used at one point. So before, you needed the proprietary Cisco client in order to make a VPN connection. Then in Snow Leopard, they built that capability into the operating system. And once you define this interface, typically you're going to be providing the name of the VPN server or network device, whatever it is, and probably a username and password.
Huh.
And once that happens, yeah, if everything's working properly, then all of a sudden your computer will magically be part of that network.
Yes. And it, there is an option to set, especially for Chris here, when you're creating this VPN, if you hit, I believe it's advanced, you can, in fact, you know what? I can open it up on this computer. I want to get this right. By default, I think, yeah. So if you've created this VPN, you go to advanced, you want to make sure on the options tab that the send all traffic over VPN connection is checked. Now, for some use cases, you may not want this. If your only reason for using the VPN is to gain access to the devices that are also part of the VPN's network, then you don't need to check this box. In fact, it's far more efficient not to, because when you go to load something like Facebook, you want to just load that directly. You don't want to have to tunnel through your home connection to get that. But in Chris's case, he does want to sacrifice some of that throughput or some of that performance for or some of that efficiency, I guess, is really the right term to use for the security of going everything through the VPN. Of course, you're limited not by your downstream connection at home, but by your upstream, which is typically the slower of the two, because it has to now download all this stuff and then send it back to you up the pipe. So in Chris's case, you want to make sure that box is checked. In other cases, like for me, when I'm traveling and really my only reason to use the VPN is to access home resources, it's actually really handy not to have it go through, but yet still be connected. So you can break that, and you can choose that option on your iPhone or your iPad as well. The iOS devices have the ability to decide that too.
Can I jump in though?
Yeah, I was just going to say,
okay, yeah, there are people out there also that are either on satellite or some people still on dial up. Hush, you say. And those people obviously can't VPN into their homes. So there are services out there like Strong VPN, Hotspot VPN for $7-$8 a month. And that's what I was using before I went to the router method. So
okay,
there are commercial services that allow you to use their servers as VPNs, and that creates that secure tunnel that you're looking for.
Okay. And I know a lot of people were using those types of services if they were overseas and wanted to gain access.
If you want to watch your Netflix and exactly, you don't want the sorry, you're not in country error. Yep.
Yeah, you can't stream Netflix if you have a US Netflix account and you're trying to stream from, you know, I don't know, Japan or Hong Kong or whatever. You cannot, and Netflix won't let you do it. But if you send all your traffic through your VPN, well, now Netflix thinks you're at your house and they'll stream the stuff happily. Of course, it again goes through that inefficiency of routing through your house, but it gets the job done. So. Anything else, John, before we move on to yet another geeky topic?
More geeky.
I know. I hope you folks are enjoying this show.
How can you get more geeky than that?
Well, we're about to show you.
All right,
Pete.
Here it goes. Okay. How funny I should ask, huh?
Now, the comment you made before, I agree. And so our article comes to this conclusion. And then I'm surprised that they still allow people to log in with a non-secure page. Because as you probably all know, but if you don't, if you preface a web page with HTTPS.
Right.
Then everything is secured using SSL. And I've seen this option also, Dave, and I'll typically enable it.
Assuming
even Twitter.
Assuming the host supports it.
Right. For example, I can go to https://facebook.com, and as far as I can tell, that's a secure connection. But I also have that option, you know, like for example, the Twitter client I use has an option saying, hey, would you like to encrypt your Twitter stream with SSL? I mean, a lot of it's open. But sometimes, you know, like if you're sending a DM or something like that, that may be somewhat private. So, yeah. So always look for an SSL option in whatever software you're using, whether it be, you know, email or web browser, to avoid these sort of problems. But,
yep. Cool. All right. Ready to dive even into geekier waters. Let's let Tom take us in. Tom writes, I do at home a fair bit of video using Final Cut and also quite a bit of Photoshop. My question is, would the X-Grid feature on macOS 10 make any difference in the performance of these applications? Do they need to be connected by Ethernet cable to get a big difference, or would wireless also see a big increase? Last question, any idea of what type of performance increase you would see while rendering out a movie? Any info on this would be appreciated. Okay. So the first thing that I want to briefly discuss, and we'll, I think in our discussion, we'll probably touch on more of this, but in a very general sense, X-Grid is the ability to have multiple computers, Mac OS X's ability to have multiple computers working on the same job. It's a distributed computing architecture or feature, I guess. And it is. It's built into Mac OS X client, and you can manage it with the server and all of that stuff. Apple made a big deal about this when Mac OS, I think it was Tiger came out, right? 10.4 was when we saw X-Grid. And really, we haven't heard a lot about it since then. Tom highlights the use case that many of us would like to use, you know, crunching videos in iMovie or, you know, dealing with pictures in Photoshop or even in iPhoto, right? You know, anything where you're sitting and waiting for your computer to get a job done. Well, yeah, what's this X-Grid thing? I got a network of computers. Can I use that? And John, the answer is, well, not really.
Unless...
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what you do is you go to the application you're using, you go to the preferences, and you find the preference that lets you specify an X-Grid controller.
That's right. Yeah. Good luck.
No, I'm being entirely serious.
That's absolutely right. Yeah. Good luck finding that in any application that Apple has for us to do this stuff. Right. That's the sad part of this is that the apps themselves, in order to make this work, the apps have to be built to separate, let's think about this, right? You've got multiple computers. You want them all to work on this job. Well, your app needs to know, let's say it's crunching video, for example, doesn't matter what the app is, but it's going to do some job that normally would take, you know, an hour or two on one computer to crunch this video. Well, the app needs to be written to break that job up into multiple segments and then farm those segments out to these other things. The X-Grid controller can decide where they're going to go and manage, you know, who has what and, you know, reassemble it all when it comes back in. But the app needs to be written to chunk it up. And none of these apps are. And that's the problem. I think, John, you looked a little deeper into this, but I think it's possible to submit any application to X-Grid, but only from the command line. And even then, it's only going to run on one computer unless it's built to go and do this, you know, multiple segment type job. Right.
Here's what I found. So you're correct. And I think the term that they used in order to consider a job, even a candidate for this, it has to be performing a task. I think they call it embarrassing or obviously parallel, and I think they have the word embarrassing in there. I'll find it in the documentation. But it's a problem that when you look at it, it's very easy to take it and break it up into little bite-sized pieces. And I would say that rendering a movie is a good candidate. A lot of graphic operations, you got a fixed set of data.
Right.
You know, or fixed size data, you got to fix the definition of what's going to be done, what algorithm's going to be run, and it's probably going to come back in a you know, reasonable amount of time.
Right. Yes.
So because I tried, I did. And actually, Dave, this is a recurring theme here, is that the ability to run X-Grid, although another nice feature on Mac OS X server, because server lets you define the controller and the agents and what else? And the clients. So I guess there's three parties in an X-Grid system.
Right.
You can invoke this on Mac OS X client as well. And I actually found a little, I was actually trying it on my MacBook Pro, which is not running server, but I found a cool little prep pane called X-Grid Lite, which gives you a prep pane that lets you activate X-Grid on your computer.
Yeah.
When it's running client. And I was able to submit jobs, but the thing is, Dave, so the mechanics, or at least the stuff that I went through with the command line, is that I was able to submit a job. Or they give you a sample, which is a better way to do it. So it does, I think, a Mandelbrot calculation. So it knows how to break up, and eventually you'll see something render on the screen. And if you watch the controller on the other machine, you'll see it handing out these jobs to the different computers. So I think any job can be submitted, but whether it's been written to think in little pieces is the key. I mean, if the app is just going to render the movie, then there's no point, because I don't think X-Grid is smart enough to say, I'm going to break up the job for you. So your software has to have an accommodation somewhere. And they have a programmer's guide that I found that you know, gives you a process to do this. But I think the answer is, yeah, like you said, is that I'm not aware of any off-the-shelf application software that knows how to talk X-Grid.
Yeah, what you don't want the whole application going X-Grid. For example, take iMovie, right? You don't want any time you launch it to have it launch on four different computers, or even one, and not know where it's running. You want to be able to interact with it on your computer. You want to launch it on your computer. But then you would want it to, when you say go, and you know, you set all your parameters, you build your movie, you do everything you want, and then you say, okay, go, render this thing. That's the point at which you want it to chunk it up and go farm it out and then bring it all back. And it's simply not written to do that. Handbrake is one I use a lot, and I would love for it to be, gridified, if you would, because it takes, on my machine, it's a dual core machine that I run it on, and it takes a couple hours per movie. Well, it'd be great if I could get it to take 15 minutes per movie and utilize all these cores that are just sitting around. If I had an 8-core, machine that I ran it on, then it would do it. But it's not as simple as just saying, yeah, run it on these processors. You need to decide what data is going where, and you need to be efficient about it, because you're using the network to move that data back and forth. There is a piece of software, actually, that I used to use a lot called DVD to 1X. It's DVD to ONEX or DVD to 110. And it's built to do something similar to Handbrake. It takes the data from a DVD and crunches it down to fit in a smaller size. And it didn't support X-Grid, or doesn't support X-Grid. It does, but it does support a grid mode of its own. And what you do is you launch DVD to 1X on multiple computers. And on one, you put it in master mode, and on the others, you put it in slave mode. And it operates just like I talked about. You go on the master and you configure what you want to happen. You set your parameters, you pick which movie, and then you say go. And at that point, it starts blasting the job out to all these other computers. Even it didn't make it that much faster. Because again, there's all that, you're moving a lot of data across the network. So, there might have been a way to make it more efficient. I don't know, on their side. But even they said, look, you're not going to see a huge increase with this, but you might see something. And it was actually pretty cool to be able to see the CPUs on all these machines just all of a sudden fire up. Yeah. And it was. I mean, it definitely went faster. It wasn't, if I was running on three computers, it wasn't three times faster. There was definitely some overhead lost, but it might have been twice as fast. And that's, for a computer that was just going to sit there idle anyway, that's not a bad thing. But,
and
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think they let it kind of fade into obscurity, because some of the web pages are the original material on X-Grid. I saw that kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not be addressed. But also now, I think the thing is, in the age of multi-core processors, is the unless you're talking, a rendering farm, like if, like Pixar or someone like that making a movie and they use something I think called Renderman, which obviously does some sort of distributed processing.
Right.
on those frames. But I think that may have taken a back seat. So there's still going to be people that are hardcore and want to, run whatever that needs thousands of processors. But, with what you can get right now on the Mac, I mean, what can you get up to 16 now, I think?
Yeah, is that right? I should know this off the top of my head. Can the Mac Pro do 16?
Oh, I thought it was 24 virtual cores.
Yeah.
On the Mac Pro.
Yeah. Yeah. The cops are coming to get us because we don't know.
Hold on.
We don't know what happened. That's right.
I got to talk to these people. I'll be right back.
Okay, yeah. You do that, John. And I'm going to go ahead and read Chris's question. Chris says, I just got my first MacBook Air Friday, and I am loving it. It complements my 27-inch iMac and my iPhone and iPad. I had, up until this weekend, a 3-month-old 13-inch and 1-year-old 15-inch MacBook Pro, which I sold within the hour after posting on Craigslist. I purchased the 13-inch with 2 gigabytes of RAM, 256 gig of an SSD, and the 1.86 gigahertz processor. I've been using it nonstop. I've loaded all my programs, including VMware Fusion and Windows 7, and still have 190 gigs of space left on the SSD. The reason for Windows 7 is that I have to be able to access IE for a work issue. The main programs I run, based on what I see open in the dock, constantly and consistently, are Mail, Safari, Text Expander, Launch Bar, iStat Menu, Keynote, and occasionally, of course, VMware Fusion. My first question is this, RAM. I look at Activity Monitor and I see remaining system memory drop as low as 40 megabytes with all of this activity, but don't see any degradation in the operation of my computer. Should I be concerned about the lack of remaining system memory? Will it at some point impact the smoothness of the computer operating properly and smoothly? If so, or do you think I'd be better off getting a MacBook Air with more horsepower? I do have 14 days to return it and upgrade to the maximum MacBook Air if necessary. I do plan on making this my only notebook because I'm hooked on the form factor. I love this machine. And I guess I'll read the second question and we'll answer them in order. Question number two, I recently started working in a PC environment and as part of my responsibility to create a lot of keynotes, or at least I try to use Keynote. When I create a keynote and share it as a PowerPoint, some of the text doesn't convert, spacing, and alignment, as well as with the videos. It's frustrating because I'm then forced to use MS Office PowerPoint and tweak them and insert other video formats. Would I be better off creating them in Office for Mac and not bother with Keynote? I'm really looking for a way to hand these presentations off without touching them twice. Okay, so my quick answer to number two before we dig into number one is, yeah, if the goal is to, and I've said this about everything, if the goal is to create something in PowerPoint format or Word format or Excel format, and it has to live in that format, and you're doing anything more than just rudimentary formatting, create it in that piece of software initially. It's just not worth the headache of that conversion. It's not going to be perfect. It's simply just not, you know, it just doesn't work that way. So yeah, I would say to create it in Office for Mac. And you can try the new Office 11.
Yeah, I got that. I just found it one day. Anyways, no, what I would suggest, that I've run into this as well, is, you know, if you can, I've seen one source of problems is that if the font that you use isn't available on the other machine,
yeah,
then these sort of things happen. So if you
that's
can
true.
At all
that
guarantee...
With PowerPoint, too.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So if you can at all make sure that the font that you're using... is one where you know it's going to be on the PowerPoint on the other end, then that I found that helps. But yep. Yeah, you're right. I mean, there's nothing's perfect as far as exporting to a format, I guess, because a lot of them are kind of closed. So,
yep. All right. So to his RAM question, I want to answer this in a couple separate parts. Just because the Mac OS X is built to maximize the use of RAM. And as such, it's not uncommon for you to see your remaining memory or free memory drop down below 100 megabytes. That in and of itself does not mean that you've run out of RAM. However, it's likely that you've run out of RAM simply because you're running with 2 gigs. And John, you want to explain how to look for that or some of the things to check?
The symptoms,
right.
And there are a couple of symptoms. So one, Dave, is do you have any swap files?
Mm. And how would I know if I have swap files, John?
I don't know.
I've checked for
you. Know,
I'm trying to quit, but you know.
Wait. Oh, okay. It is in a... okay. So you could look where I think he was looking before. So you can look in Activity Monitor.
Yep.
That will show you swap used, how many bytes. And for example, right now my MacBook is using 0 bytes, which is outstanding. So
let's talk about that, because we're looking in Activity Monitor, and then at the bottom there's a set of 5 what Apple calls
right.
tabs.
I did system memory, and it shows swap used. That's because I was going to suggest something else, because I don't think that's quite enough information, or at least other programs give you more.
Right, but let's use this as a quick barometer. And yet there is another place or another way we can look, but. You know, swap you. So you've got 0. That indicates that for whatever you've done with the machine since you rebooted, essentially, you're okay, or what you're doing with it now, because the machine will dynamically allocate this. But, you know, at what number is that going to be a problem? So because mine is showing that I've got 23 megs of swap used, that still isn't a problem from my standpoint. I think if you're going over 300 or 400 megabytes of swap used, then yeah. You're consistently running out of memory. Mm-hmm. So
I've had gigabytes. The only time I've had that happen.
Sure. Yeah.
Well, the only time I have that happen is if I have a need to run VMware.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have it normally. I think I have it set for 3 gigs or 4 gigs, and my machine has 6. So, you got to give Windows a little breathing room.
That's right. Yeah, it's a whole other operating.
But that's when I know, because then the system just starts getting slow. And the other thing I can see, Dave. So one thing is I see that the size of the VM gets larger.
Yeah.
And the other is that you're going to notice this figure page outs.
Okay.
The more of those occurring, the more likely you're going to see degradation in performance.
Yep.
Because that's when you're doing the shuffle between physical memory and... Though, you know, I just thought about this, Dave. In this case, with the Air, with an SSD, you definitely will not notice as much degradation versus a mechanical drive.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because you're moving from RAM to RAM. Now, the RAM inside an SSD and the access to it is still much slower than access to your actual RAM in the machine. But it's much faster than it would be, as you said, John, to access a mechanical drive. I was very close to upgrading my machine. You know, I've got 4 gigs of RAM in my machine. That's very close to upgrading that. And then sort of backed off once I put the SSD in, because I no longer experienced. I still see it when I look in Activity Monitor or any of the other tools. I still see that I'm paging out, but I don't feel it, if that makes sense, because it's much, much faster writing out to the swap files and managing all that stuff. Still get some of it, though, as it pauses to create or destroy a swap file, but it works.
Right. Now, to his question.
Yes.
If he should, in my personal opinion, as to the question of whether he should get more.
Yeah.
My answer is yes.
Yeah.
2 gigs. The thing is, you can get too little memory, but it's not a bad thing if you have too much memory, but it's a bad thing if you have too little. And if for no other reason than, you know, resale value. But 2 to me is, I would not even be comfortable running any Mac OS X machine with just 2 gigs of RAM. To me, that's at least for you know, the type of things that I do.
That's your inner geek speaking. You're right. I mean, it 2 gigs is low, but it is very functional for a lot of people. However, in Chris's case, he points out that he's running VMware a lot, and as you said, John, you've got to chunk off at least half a gig, you know, probably a gigabyte to as a minimum to VMware to run Windows and at least make Windows happy. You may even find that 4 gigs you're still paging out. I certainly do. But again, you know, I've got my inner geek shines through all the time. That's why we do what we do here. So, yeah, our views on this are a little bit tainted because we've seen we push things to the limits anyway. For a lot of people, 2 gigs is probably going to be enough, but not for you, Chris. I think you need 4. I would go to the 4. If you could do more, I'd do it, but you can't. So,
mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. He should send that old machine here for testing. He shouldn't turn it back to Apple, right?
that's right.
Yeah, send it here. We'll see if that 2 gig works.
We'll let you know. We'll report back in time. Anything else, John, before we move on to our next questioner?
As far as I can tell, the most cores you can get is 12.
Okay. Okay.
You can get 2 6 core processors. So as far as this topic, no.
Thank you. All right, good. Okay, good. Thanks. Yeah. Yeah, we'll jump around a little bit. That's fine. All right. So to the next interrogator here is Weddle C.
Hey John and Dave. This is Weddle C in Indiana. Me and my wife both have iPhone 4s, and she was using her iTunes account and I was using mine, but she had only purchased 3 or 4 free apps, and I found out that we could share by both using my account on each of the phones, so we could share our apps. Recently, when she was going to update her apps from the iPhone, she went to update her apps, and it asked her for my password, and then it updated the apps that were in my name, and then it went and asked for her password and updated the apps on her phone. Well, I got kind of tired of that annoyance and decided to go ahead and delete out all of her apps, only put my stuff on, and then we resynced it with only my stuff, and then went and re-downloaded the ones that she was using that she had before and downloaded them in my name. Now when we go to the general settings under the store, it lists me being signed in, and I can sign out and sign back in, and it'll still be under my account. I can even go to the iTunes portion and do the same thing, and it'll show me being signed in, and I've tried signing out and signing back in. Or I can go to the App Store, and even you can, there's a trick where you can go to the Categories tab and go to the bottom, and even from that iTunes Store app on the iPhone, you can sign out and then sign back in and make sure you're under your account. Yep. And with her not having any apps in her name, whenever she goes to update her apps from the iPhone, it always asks her for her password. And even if they're apps that were in my name, if it tries to update them, it'll say, sorry, you haven't purchased these. You need to repurchase these apps. Everything works fine if you update and resync from the computer, but it's just kind of annoying sometimes. She'll be away from her computer for 2 or 3 days, and an update will come out, and she'll want to update that from the iPhone. And if it's a paid app, she can't do that under my account. And I was just wondering if there's any way to force the iPhone to clear out her old account information so that we could start updating apps from my account on her phone from the phone. Anyway, thanks for any help that you might have. Bye.
All right. So this is very interesting. It's good to discuss this topic every now and again, because it's good to remind everybody out there that you can, in fact, have the apps that you buy through the App Store can be shared to all the devices that you plug into your computer, but can also be shared to all the devices plugged into any of the 5 computers that you authenticate as being part of that iTunes Store account. Just like you could share your music with, you know, your wife or your kids or your spouse, you know, whoever, you can also share the apps the same way. So that's how things started here, obviously, with Weddle C and his wife. But then they decided they didn't want to have apps owned by 2 different users. They just wanted to do them both the same. And it seems like there's some setting lingering on that iPhone that's holding to that store account. I would, you know, and I know Weddle said he did this in, you know, in settings. There is a store section there, and you can sign in there. And then, of course, inside the store itself, there is that trick at the bottom of the categories list. When you click on App Store, you can go to categories and you can sign in and out there. It sounds like there's something left on that phone that's holding her username. And I would do a restore of the phone. I would even restore it from backup first, because, of course, that keeps all of her other settings. It may keep this one, but restoring the iPhone from backup might just be the magic answer. It might not be, but that's the first place I'd start. If you can't do it from a restore from backup, then you've got to restore it, but don't do a backup or don't let it refresh from the backup, and simply reinstall all your apps and rebuild all your settings for mail and all that stuff. You know, there is the one thing, and I don't know if this impacts store stuff or not, but if you go to general settings on the iPhone or, you know, any iOS device, settings, general, and then reset, there is a reset network settings in here, and that wipes out a lot of passwords and stuff. I don't know if it mucks with the store. It probably doesn't, but it's not a terrible thing to do. And that might get you what you need. I don't have any other thoughts on this one, John. Do you?
No, I'm only one person with one device.
This is it's beyond your scope, huh?
Well, I've heard of people complaining about this too, where they're surprised by, you know, what the device is asking for, but
yeah,
I never ran into it. No, I'm with you. Yeah. Clear it off. There's some old crap somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what it is. And a reset should do it. All right. So now we've got 2, MacBook Air troubleshooting kind of things. And it's more just general troubleshooting. It doesn't matter the computer type. So we're going to play one comment and read the other, and then talk about them a little bit as we wrap up here. So let's see what we have from, start with Connor.
Hello, Mac Geek Gabbers. This is Connor P. My mother is having some issues with her MacBook Air. according to her, I've actually yet to see it happen because I've been, I have not been around it much, but she is apparently getting a large number of kernel panics. I've sort of done all the regular voodoo maintenance, anything that's possible to do in Onyx I've done. I've flushed caches. I've repaired permissions. I have booted onto the DVD, which is quite a chore, actually, without having the actual DVD drive. I ran the Apple hardware test, so the memory is okay. I tried to repairing the disk, and the hard drive is okay. And I'm really at a loss. She's not running out of disk space. She's got about 35 gigs free on her 80 gig drive. Sorry about that. So I'm really at a loss what's causing all these issues for her. Maybe she's making it up so she can get a new MacBook Air. But I don't know. We'll just have to see. So my question is, do you know of some other causes of frequent kernel panics? This is where you cut me off.
All right, cool. And then Marcus writes, I have a request regarding my four-year-old MacBook, so actually not a MacBook Air. I recently decided to upgrade the RAM from the one gigabyte that the MacBook came with to 2 gigabytes that I bought from Crucial.com. I installed the new RAM, and shortly thereafter, the MacBook started shutting down unexpectedly. The shutdown occurs totally randomly. There is no warning. The screen goes black, and the computer is off. I can start the computer up again. It will run fine for a while. Then it will shut down again. Sometimes it works fine for 30 minutes. Other times it's only 2 minutes. I can't replicate the shutdown by doing anything specific. Like I said, it seems to be totally random. Aside from the unwanted shutdowns, the computer seems to be running fine when it's on. Since the problem started occurring shortly after I installed the new RAM, I figured that the problem must be related to it. I took the new RAM out, installed the old original RAM, thinking the problem would go away. Unfortunately, it has not. Sudden shutdowns still occur even with the original RAM installed. I checked that I had the latest firmware installed. It is. I reset the PRAM and SMC, yet the problem persists. Any ideas what might be causing this issue? All right. So we're talking about issues here. Kernel panics and shutdowns, though it's possible that they are software related more often than not, especially in when things are random. That's when to me, you know, I always start thinking hardware, but we might be able to pinpoint which hardware, or if it's not hardware, what software component is causing a problem. So,
now just to review, some may not have seen a kernel panic. What does a kernel panic on macOS 10 look like? And last I checked, Dave, and I've had a few.
Yep.
And I'm going to tell you how I know that. But first, it's usually where you get, sometimes you will see your screen start to turn gray and maybe kind of creeping downwards. And then you'll get or it's at least when I've seen it once. And you get a message, something to the, and it comes up in multiple languages, but it basically says that the machine is hosed. And hold down the power button because it's something really bad happened. I forget the exact wording.
Still working.
But it's where you will see that when you see a message in multiple languages telling you how to restart the machine, that's at least the way that I've seen a kernel panic. Now, sometimes you may see some text in the background,
yep,
depending on what problem. So if at all possible, when this does happen, ask for a picture of the screen. You may see who is causing the kernel panic. Another place to look, Dave, is our pal, the console. I love the console because there's.
Yep.
Years worth of fun-loving reading in there. But the place that you want to look so you don't get overwhelmed is the files section, /library/logs, and there's a category called Panic Reporter. And those are kernel panic reports. So poke around in one of those, and it may lead you, and I'm with you, Dave, so I'm looking at some of my recent kernel panics here.
Yep.
And I saw one here, and it had something. Okay, so one here was definitely caused by, it happened a little while ago, but this was caused by software. The some versions of the Cisco VPN client, which I've used in the past,
yes,
tend to get very intimate with the networking portion of the software in the OS, and sometimes it conflicts,
yep,
with something else. And in this case, it actually said, oh, Kernel loadable modules in Backtrace with dependencies com.cisco.nke.ipsec, blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So I'm going to say in that case, I'm pretty sure what happened is the machine wedged because something that the Cisco IPsec or the Cisco client did didn't make the Mac happy.
That's right.
And I've seen other references. You'll see them. I mean, some of it is gobbledygook and hex, but I think I saw another one where it would reference .iousb. Something, which will point to you may have a USB device. Now, in the case of the Air, I think you're pretty limited in which bus the device is connected to. I think the only one is.
Yeah. Yeah.
The USB port. So that would be my suggestion in that case. And I would tend to agree with you, Dave, that the kernel panics are usually hardware related, except in this case of a, you know, network kernel extension.
Yep. Yep. You know, there's a couple other things that I would look at here. One is, if you look in, once you reboot, you know, come back up into single user mode, you want to preserve as much of the logs as possible, and you don't want to clutter things with a new boot. So if you know, as soon as you have this kernel panic or whatever it is, the reboot, what, you know, whatever your symptom is, hold down Command S on the next boot up. That's going to bring you to single user mode, and you can use a command called more or less. Either one is fine. And type less and then space. And like you said, John, you want to look at the logs. And in this case, I recommend looking at /var/ and this is all lowercase. So we're going to say /var/log/system.log. And if you scroll to the bottom of that list with your arrow keys, and it may take some time because that can get long, you can look and there'll be timestamps next to each event. You might be able to see what happened right before that reboot happened. It might have gotten logged in here. And if it did, it's going to give you a pretty good indication as to what caused the problem. Another place to look, same place, /var/log/kernel.log. Same sort of thing. That's going to provide a little bit a different look at what's gone on. And between those two, you may find something that's giving you a good indication. If that kernel panic didn't get written, you might still see something leading up to that in either or both of these logs. Those are my favorite places to look. It's possible on Marcus's with the RAM swapping that you shorted out something on the motherboard when you went in there or nudged something, nudged the motherboard. And now the motherboard is shorting out occasionally on the case. Anytime you go in and out of a computer, it's possible, of course, to damage other components or move other components that have nothing to do with the, you know, whatever it is you went in there to do. So,
and I'm going to ask a question because it wasn't clear to me when this happened. And I had this happen to me once, Dave.
Yep.
A number of years ago. And this was with my tie book, as they called it.
Yep.
And here was the problem with that machine. They had what I would consider a faulty case design. And you could, if you carried the machine, much to my shock, if you carried the machine with you and you flex the case just so, just by holding it, the battery would disconnect. So I'm with you, but because this machine, I believe, if we're talking a 4-year-old machine here, yeah, it may be that the battery is kind of wobbling about in there and maybe something got nudged. So I'm building on your suggestion, but I think something may have gotten moved a little bit, like one of the battery contacts. Now, my question is, does this happen when you're plugged into the power adapter? If it does, then I would lean towards what you suggested. If it only happens with the battery, then I would question either the battery itself. I mean, it could be just a coincidence that it's a faulty battery, that right, the battery just, you know, has some big problems and just decides to, you know, like a bad cell, for example.
Right.
Or it could be, you know, just disconnecting momentarily. And I saw it. I mean, it freaked me out the first time it happened. I'm like, I just got this new machine. I brought it from home and to work. And I'm like, hey, everybody check this out. And then somebody's like, huh, how'd you turn it off? I'm like, oh no, what a piece of... they fixed it. Cool. So, or I think they replaced the batteries. There's something wrong with the mold on the battery. So
yeah, kernel panics, again, you know, the way to tell if it's software versus hardware, or the way I tell, is if I'm trying to do a certain operation and every time I try to do that operation, the machine fails, then to me, that's software because it's a repeatable thing. But with hardware, sometimes it's repeatable and consistent. Again, like you said, with a faulty USB device or something like that. But otherwise, you know, usually it's the random stuff that back when I was doing consulting, that was always the thing that kind of set off the, you know, the Spidey sense alarm. It was like, wait a minute, this is not making sense. Let's start thinking about hardware as a potential culprit here. And more often than not, that's what it turned out to be. Anything else on this before we wrap up here, John?
No, I think I'm done.
All right, good. Michael sent in not Michael Johnston, but a different Michael sent in a poem titled "A Poem for Those Over 30," and I wanted to share it with you folks here because it certainly gave us a chuckle. So here we go. A poem for those over 30. A computer was something on TV from a science fiction show of note. A window was something you hated to clean, and Ram was the cousin of a goat. Meg was the name of my girlfriend, and Gig was a job for the nights. Now they all mean different things, and that really megabytes. An application was for employment. A program was a TV show. A cursor used profanity. A keyboard was a piano. Memory was something that you lost with age. A CD was a bank account. And if you had a 3-inch floppy, you hoped nobody found out. Compress was something you did to the garbage, not something you did to a file. And if you unzipped anything in public, you'd be in jail for a while. Log on was adding wood to the fire. Hard drive was a long trip on the road. A mouse pad was where the mouse lived, and a backup happened to your commode. Cut you did with a pocket knife. Paste you did with glue. A web was a spider's home, and a virus was the flu. I guess I'll stick to my pad and paper and the memory in my head. I hear nobody's been killed in a computer crash, but when it happens, they'll wish they were dead. Thanks for sending that in, Michael. copy we have, the author is unknown, and I think that's just perfect. Let's see, John, we have contact info. I know all of you, and again, our thanks to you for being supporters of the show with the premium subscription. We know you know how to contact us, but we're going to remind you anyway. Email to premium@macgeekgab.com.
Premium? At MacGeekGab.com.
That's right. You heard.
All right. Well, if you're going to say that, then you know what I'm going to say?
What's that?
You could also call us, Dave, and you'd want to call us at 206-666-GEEK.
Which is 4335. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab. You can find us on Twitter. I'm Dave Hamilton. John's John F. Braun. Pete is Pilot Pete. MacGeekGab on Twitter will get you notifications about the show, when it comes out, when the show notes are done, all that stuff. And of course, Mac Observer on Twitter gets you everything from TMO. I'd like to thank Michael Johnston, who I mentioned before, from the We Have Communicators podcast. He's the one that converts this to AAC for you. And of course, Cashfly provides all the bandwidth. I think that's it. We're out of here. We're out of here until next week.
Wow.
Yeah. Right? That's it. All right. I don't have anything else to add.
I got nothing.
All right.
I'm going to go and rake some leaves.
You do that.
Well, they'll pick them up. Well, I got to put them in bags. Let me come pick them up. Yeah.
I'll be in London this weekend. Sweet.
Have fun in London. I hear you're going to have some trouble with the scanners there, so don't get caught with those nudie scanners, Pete.
Made up.